Today on Off Mic, a candidate for Congress in Northwest Indiana responds to being victim shamed this week for her connection to the disciplinary case against Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill. A native of Northwest Indiana is now the head of the Disney Empire. A local director talked about his work on August Wilson plays. It's the first Friday of Lent, so that means fish fries. And we check on spring training for the Sox and the Cubs, and who is the new Bulls' new breakout star? All this on Off Mic. First, the news. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill could be facing a 60-day suspension of his law license, which could impact his ability to serve as Attorney General and his race for re-election this year. It all stems from a March 2018 incident at an Indianapolis bar where a party was happening, and Hill is alleged to have acted inappropriately toward four women, including touching them. One of them was Indiana State Representative Mara Candelaria Reardon, a Democrat from Munster, who is now one of several candidates running to replace Pete Visclosky in Congress. Reardon's allegations and that of the three other legislative staffers were deemed credible enough for the Indiana Supreme Court's Disciplinary Commission to seek sanctions against Hill. Earlier this month, former state Supreme Court Judge Myra Selby recommended the suspension of Hill's license after several days of testimony from witnesses back in the fall. That recommendation must still be acted upon by the Indiana Supreme Court. But that didn't stop a local radio personality from calling out Reardon's account of what happened with Curtis Hill and questioning her readiness to serve in Congress. I spoke to Representative Reardon earlier this week. She was joined by her attorney, Hannah Kaufman-Joseph. I asked Representative Reardon, does she see this as victim shaming?
I like to just call it woman shaming, frankly. It's not the way men are treated if anything occurs to them outside their control or their boundaries. And we are held to a higher standard of conduct, frankly.
And I think I would just want to jump in and say that I think what's really unfortunate is the conflating of the two issues. Representative Reardon was one of several victims that night. And she is pursuing the investigation and legal adjudication of this matter in the proper course. And as was discussed in the other comments that were made, there was a reference to the necessity of a trial and of a fact finder, and that's exactly what Representative Reardon and the other victims of Attorney General Curtis Hill are doing, is pursuing a judicial review of the behavior, and to bring that up as a way to question Representative Reardon's qualifications or credibility is just an old trick and an old song that we hear when victims tell the truth about what's happened to them.
Yeah, Representative Reardon, some of the comments that came out also question your ability to serve in Congress based on how your reaction to what happened with Attorney General Curtis Hill. How do you respond to that?
Well, I respond by saying that as I fought for myself and the other women that night that were victimized by Curtis Hill, as I fought for them, I would continue to fight for Northwest Indiana. I did not take it and quietly hide. I went to the proper authorities and I sought relief from his behavior. This is not something that I will continue to fight in the same way, in the same manner. This isn't something that's new to me. I've fought for healthcare. I've fought for a myriad of issues in the state house, and I'm not going to allow something that happened to me stop me from doing that. I will continue to speak truth to power when I need to.
Yeah, and it seems a little odd that, I mean, the situation happened 2 years ago before anybody, any congressional race was up and your candidacy was announced. It seems a little odd that something that happened 2 years ago would prevent you from doing something else in the future.
Well, you know, and I'm not going to allow that. I'm not going to allow that. I didn't allow it. I didn't allow it to go unchecked, and I'm not going to allow it to go unchecked now.
And I would just want to add that we this case is has nothing political to do with it. There's no political angle here. In fact, the victims are from both parties, and really the politics of this case are completely irrelevant. And there are no politics of this case, Representative Reardon. This happened in a political sphere. But beyond that, there is no political motivation. There are people that want leaders that conduct themselves with dignity. And, you know, that's what true leadership is. And I am not going to allow a local radio station personality to dictate my story and my life. I will continue to fight for Northwest Indiana. That's the bottom line here. And I've done it for the last 2 years. It's interesting, as you said, that she's chosen to chime in as I'm a congressional candidate. That is, to me, a very clear signal that she would like to challenge my credibility. And this is the only thing that she can come up with, is trying to minimize my abilities and question my integrity.
Well, Representative Reardon, thank you for joining me here on Off Mic.
Thank you for having us.
And we'll be back with more Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Michael Puente. Well, earlier this week, Northwest Indiana got some shocking news that a native of Hammond is now the head of the Disney Entertainment Empire.
When I was growing up in Hammond, Indiana, my parents would take us on a family vacation to Walt Disney World every year. That's where I first developed a deep love for Disney and all that it stands for.
That's Bob Chapek, a native of Hammond, Indiana, who grew up in the Robertsdale neighborhood. He was talking on a conference call earlier this week. Chapek graduated from Clark High School in 1977. Chapek will be replacing longtime Disney CEO Bob Iger. Earlier this week, I got a chance to speak to one of Bob Chapek's former teachers at Clark, Gary Ridgely. Mr. Ridgely was Chapek's math teacher. He now lives in Las Vegas. Mr. Ridgely, how long did you teach at Clark High School?
Yeah, I taught there for 32 years. And actually, Bob would have been in my, second class that I taught there. I started in 73, so that would have been 73, 74, and then he was a sophomore in 75, so that would have been the 74, 75 year. So he was in my second geometry class.
Well, if you can think way back then, I think you already have a little bit. What type of student was he?
Bob was a good student. I'll tell you what, he was with a great group of kids. Now, Bob was, I'm pretty sure he ran track and maybe cross country. I was a football coach and a baseball coach, and a lot of his friends were actual baseball players. So, you know, I mean, they hung around together. I knew them more than him, other than being inside the classroom. So I didn't know that much about him outside the classroom.
When did you retire from Clark?
In 2005, and then moved out to Vegas, and I taught at Green Valley High School here for 7 years.
How do you feel that one of your former students is now head of the most powerful entertainment company in the world?
Well, you know, it's rather a unique situation because My son works for Amazon, who I also had in class, but many years later, he's much younger. And he is going to be the Amazon liaison for Disney for the cloud. That's what his job is, basically. And he was going to be working like under Bob Chapek in Parks and Recreation. Well, now that'll be changed a little bit because Bob has gone, up to a higher level. So I don't know how much he'll interact with them. But I had been telling my son for a while that I thought he needed to call, or email Bob and say, hey, we've got something in common. We both had the toughest math teacher in the history of Clark High School. Well, you were a little bit luckier because I had to go home to him also. Just to break the ice a little bit and stuff like that. And I think Bob would have got a kick out of that, I think. It would have, you never know, opened up another door somewhere along the line. Bob was the head of the Parks and Recreation aspect. I think that was like the number three guy, if I can remember how their pyramid goes. But he was over all of the parks. So that would have been like Disneyland, Disney World, Japan, and all the other ones that they have, wherever those are. And about 4 years ago, I think it was, is when they actually got started into the cloud, using the cloud for a lot of the computer stuff. And my son was one of them that kind of got it started a little bit. He then left Disney and went with Amazon into the cloud. And now it's kind of going full circle back. And he'll be moving to Orlando from Las Vegas in the near future and kind of being their liaison for all of the stuff that they're doing in the cloud now.
So what is your son's name?
Randy Ridgely.
That is amazing. That's just amazing. I grew up in Northwest Indiana, too. I'm from East Chicago.
Okay.
And, obviously the area gets kind of a black eye. It's very industrial. Definitely. Outside, in the shadow of Chicago, kind of ignored by Indianapolis. What does it say that somebody who grew up in this area, I'm assuming Robertsdale, in Hammond, can make it this high in any industry, let alone the entertainment industry?
Absolutely. And the amazing part about it is that we've got a few of those type of kids that are moving in that direction. And it's really kind of weird that this is happening at this time, because I don't know how much you keep up with Northwest Indiana and actually Hammond. But after next year, Clark will no longer be. They're closing it. I don't know if they're going to tear it down or what they're going to do with it, but it won't be around anymore. And so, like you said, you've got a guy that is one of the most powerful corporations there is, and he's the head of it, coming from a school that's no longer going to be in existence. It's sad, but it's also it makes you puff your chest out a little bit, and I feel pretty good. And that, like I said, his group has been a very good group of kids that I was lucky enough that I was not only the teacher, but I happened to have the class of 77 sponsorship. So I was around those kids a lot more as a group. And we've got a lot of notable people that have done very, very well.
Wow. Wow. All right. And you probably haven't seen Bob since he left that class that one day long time ago. But I'm sure you're still certainly very proud of him.
Oh, extremely. And what's really interesting is that, he came back. They started a program, I want to say maybe 7-8 years ago, where they try to bring somebody back for the graduation commencement speech. And I want to say that Bob might have been the very first one that they got to come back and give the address to the graduating seniors.
Well, we'd like to thank Mr. Ridgely for joining us here on Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio, and we'll be back with more Off Mic. Well, welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Michael Puente. August Wilson was an American playwright whose works include a series of 10 plays, The Pittsburgh Cycle, for which he received 2 Pulitzer Prizes for drama. Each work is in the series set in a different decade and depicts comic and tragic aspects of the African-American experience in the 20th century. August Wilson died in 2005 at the age of 60. Through this weekend, one of August Wilson's plays, Gem of the Ocean, is being featured at the Civic Theater in South Bend. It launches the theater's 10-year, 10-play August Wilson project to produce the playwright's entire American Century cycle. Gem of the Ocean, is being directed by Chicagoan Aaron Mays. And Aaron joins us by phone to talk about his production. Welcome to Off Mic, Aaron.
Glad to be here.
Aaron, well, tell me a little bit about Gem of the Ocean. Why did you want to direct this play?
For sure. Well, this play definitely has this mixture of magical elements to it, as well as some of the everyday realism that people go through. The play talks about a young man named Citizen Barlow who comes up from Alabama wanting to get his soul cleansed. So he hears of this woman named Aunt Esther, or Esther Tyler, who is reported to have this gift. And so he takes him in, and through his stay with her, he meets a range of people who help him really go from boyhood to manhood, and also to get his soul washed or to be redeemed from this crime he's committed. And by doing so, he goes to this place called the City of Bones, this mythical place that is a half mile by half mile made of bones. And so this really intriguing story about how does one be able to find their own redemption, their own freedom in the midst of chaos is something that August really does this magnificent job of doing in some really ordinary ways, but also some really, like I said, magical ways to the theater.
Yeah, Aaron, before we get too far into the play itself, tell me a little bit about yourself and for our listener audience. We're broadcasting in Northwest Indiana. I've known you for a long time, but we want to hear more about you.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm a playwright director based in Chicago, originally from upstate New York, and started doing theater professionally around 2013, where I had left a job and decided to try this theater thing and see how far it would take me. And actually landed my first gig as assistant director for an August Wilson play, which was Seven Guitars at Court Theater. And from there, the career really just started taking off with different offers to either assistant direct or direct. And then finally landed this role to direct my first August Wilson play at the South Bend Civic.
Well, tell me, how much work has gone into this play? I mean, it's pretty extensive. When did rehearsals start taking place on this?
Yeah, we started back, we did auditions back in October, and I wanted to really work over the holidays, or start before the holidays. And so we did auditions, like I said, in October, and then started doing some preliminary table work, basically going through the script with the actors, really just trying to understand what each word, each line, each sentence, each scene really meant. Most people know that for really experienced writers, that nothing is a mistake on the page. Everything is there for a reason. So we spent the time before the holidays hit to really go through the work line by line and to really ask some really deep questions about the script. And then from there, the actors were on their own to really learn the lines and come back in January, where we really hit an intensive four-day a week rehearsal.
Well, this is going to embark on a 10-year commitment by the theater to do all of August Wilson's, all of his plays. Are you going to be involved in anything more after this one?
We hope so. We're still trying to get through this weekend. This is our closing weekend. But hopefully I get a chance to come back. I know there's some talk about it right now from folks at the theater. So we'll have to wait and see.
You know, and if those who may be unfamiliar with August Wilson, one of his plays is Fences, which just a couple of years ago, it was made into a movie starring Denzel Washington and did really, really well at the movies. Really powerful, powerful movie. Aaron, tell us a little bit about in terms of you had opening night last weekend in Indiana, in South Bend. How did that go?
Oh, wonderful. We ended the night with a standing ovation, which is always great, you know, as a director to see people standing on their feet in support of the work. And the buzz around town is that it's really starting to make an impact, not just in terms of a piece of theater, but also as the conversation started about race, ancestry, history. How do we reconcile our past that often has, that's often riddled with tragic moments, atrocities, human rights violations? How do we then address that? And then move forward, right? Or move forward in a way where we can acknowledge it and then try to write a new narrative where people can actually talk about these things in terms of community activism, in terms of reconciliation. So people really see it as a really historic step in the theater, as a being a vehicle to talk about social change, social justice, talk about racial diversity. And so I'm really happy to be a part of that.
Aaron, what is the redeeming value of the Gem of the Ocean? What's the overall theme that you think people are going to take away, the overall message of this play?
Yeah, for me, you know, I've been thinking about that a lot because the play runs about 3 hours. And so it covers a wide range of issues from love, loss, the Underground Railroad, historical elements. Since the play is set in 1904. But the three things I really want people to walk away with in this production is one, redemption, freedom, and resistance. Those three main topics, because the play centers on those three elements really heavily. And looking at freedom, it's two-sided in this play, where you have Simpson Barlow, who's one of the main characters, who's really grappling with his own shame in terms of this crime he's committed, which is more of a personal freedom. And then you have Sally Two Kings, who's one of the main characters as well, who is one of the original freedom fighters. He was on the Underground Railroad. He freed 62 or 63 people by doing that trek back and forth north to south. And so you have this communal freedom, one that beckons a higher call beyond just oneself. And so really you get to see how those two freedoms play out, how they interact, how both are needed for a community of people who have known such darkness as being in bondage. And so it's a really deep investigation about that type of personal call for community and also for an uplifting message as well about the power of resistance.
You know, Aaron, you've produced a lot of plays and been involved in a lot of productions, both in Chicago. If this play was being done in downtown Chicago, say at the Goodman Theater where you've done work before, would it be any different? Would you try to convey it any different than, say, for an audience in South Bend, Indiana?
Actually, I would say probably not. You know, as I talked to the cast and any cast I work with, that I said, no matter if I'm working off Broadway, which I have before, or working at a small storefront, we always produce professional theater. I never want to look at theater as in tiers, like, oh, this is just a community theater, so we're going to stop at the easiest answer. That no matter what work we do, we always approach it with the level of excellence, a level of professionalism, and that goal should never stop because of money or because of the size of the theater or whatever the case may be. And so for me, we always have to, as artists, we have the responsibility and we have that demand to be able to give audiences in the community with what I believe is our best.
Can you tell me when Showtimes are for this weekend?
For sure. So we have a show tonight and tomorrow at 7:30 Eastern time, and then 2 p.m. on Sunday, which is our closing. And again, that's also.
That's right. We got to remind folks, if you're coming from Chicago or Northwest Indiana, South Bend, you lose an hour. They're an hour ahead, but when you return, it feels like you're coming back to the future. You gain an hour. Well, you know, I've dealt with Aaron Mays for such a long time in various capacities. You know, he hasn't really displayed his high energy in this interview like he normally does, but you know, hopefully that'll come out sooner or later, because Aaron's just a wonderful, wonderful person to talk to. I'm just so happy for his production. Well, Aaron, good luck. He's the director of Gem of the Ocean at South Bend Civic Theater. Good luck this weekend, Aaron, and thank you for joining us here on Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Thanks a million.
Well, coming up, it's Friday, it's Lent. That means it's fish fry time, and we'll get the lowdown and a local fish fry in Northwest Indiana coming up. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Michael Puente. It's Friday, and it's also Lent. It's the first Friday of the Lenten season, and for many Catholics, that means, or it's supposed to mean, no meat. And that also means fish fries at local churches. Rosalia Liel is helping to organize one today, fish fry, at St. Catherine of Siena in Hammond. She joins us by phone to talk about today's fish fry. Hello, Rosalia, how are you?
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Fantastic. So, you know, I love going to fish fries primarily because it smells so good, and I love hearing them making the fish. Tell us a little bit about all the work that you're doing at St. Catherine of Siena.
Sure. We are starting off with our first fish fry today, and we have, through the whole Lent, about 6 fish fries to organize, and, you know, from the chefs that are doing the frying to the servers that are taking out the orders to the people, and the people that are also preparing desserts and salads.
Rosalia, tell us, you know, how much preparation is there? Because I guess it's sometimes hard to tell how many people are going to show up.
Very true. I think the first fish fry is always the one that you're most nervous about, because you don't find out until after the first one how much the word has spread throughout the community and how many people are aware of our fish fry starting. So that's always, you know, and the weather too. We also, the weather has a lot to do with also a success of a fish fry, because if you have rainy, snowy, just bad conditions, people don't normally come out. They stay home and cook, and, you know, they don't contribute as much. So those are all factors that, you know, we usually look at for the first fish fry and then going forward for every Friday.
Now, Rosalia, I probably know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask you anyway. There's so many Catholic churches around, so many of them having fish fries. Is there a mm-hmm. little competition?
Not at all. You know, these fish fries are serving their community around, you know, their church. A lot of times, you know, there's some parishes that have gone for many, many years back, you know, every year to the fish fry, and they invite more and more families. So really, it's the people around in the parishers that make the, you know, the fish fries pretty successful.
So we're talking about fish fries. So what exactly is on your menu for tonight?
Well, we have jumbo shrimp. Our dinners include jumbo shrimp, ocean perch, tilapia, and all-you-can-eat salad bar. So with the dinner, you get the all-you-can-eat salad bar, you get dessert, punch, coffee, all included in the price of the dinner.
So if you're getting hungry and you're not Catholic, are you still welcome there?
Of course. We have yummy quesadillas as well in the menu.
You know, I'm Catholic, and I always feel guilty that it's supposed to be a time of sacrifice. And when I'm eating that jumbo shrimp or that delicious tilapia, I'm like, I don't feel like I'm sacrificing at all. But it's giving me an excuse to actually have more fish.
And That's right.
But how many people, I mean, considering past fish fries, past years, how many people do you kind of expect for tonight?
You know, for tonight, we're hoping to expect from 80 to 125 people.
Wow.
Like I said, usually the first one is very hard to tell. We've had some really successful fish fries where we've had, you know, up to 150 people show up in that short period of time of, you know, 3 or 4 hours or 3 hours, because you could dine in and you can carry out as well. So if you don't have time to sit down and talk to, you know, to your neighbors or the community, you could just carry your food, your fish home.
Now, Leah, Rosalia, tell me, you know, for some non-Catholics out there, the explanation of what is sort of the message behind the significance of the Lenten season?
Well, I think it's a time to meditate and have the time to, you know, to ask for some time to kind of,
sort of forgiveness and a time for reflection.
Forgiveness, sort of. Yeah, reflection, a lot of reflection, a lot of forgiveness. You know, if you don't go to church the whole year, this is really the time that people come back at this time of Lent. And, you know, they like you mentioned, it's more of a reflection of, you know, forgiveness. But then, you know, the rest of the year, I mean, you might see people come and go in the church, but usually Lent time is a very big deal, you know, in the Catholic Church, because it brings a lot of people back during that season, during that time.
Tell us again, could you the address for St. Catherine of Siena?
The address?
Yes.
It's 6525 Kentucky Street. It's in the Hessville area. It's 165th and Kentucky Street. You'll see it in the corner. You can't miss us.
And
so
what,
we will be there.
And what time is the fish fry?
At 4 o'clock. So 4 to 7 every Friday going forward all the way to April 3rd is our last fish fry. So starting tonight all the way to April 3rd every Friday, we will be there from 4 to 7.
And you're organizing every Friday fish fry?
Yes. Myself with a good team. You need a good team. We have a great team that has new members and members that have worked many fish fries. So, you know, we need both. We need both to make it run smooth.
Right. Well, Rosalia Leal is helping to organize today's fish fry at St. Catherine of Siena in Hammond. Rosalia, thank you so much for joining us here today on Off Mic.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, thank you. Well, coming up on Off Mic, we'll have a little bit about spring training for our Chicago baseball teams coming up on Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Yeah, even though it's about 18 degrees outside, it's springtime in our hearts, especially if you're a baseball fan. The Sox, the White Sox, the Cubs, and are both in Arizona gearing up for the new season, which actually starts in almost less than a month almost. Joining us to talk about the Sox, the Cubs, is veteran Chicago sports journalist Cheryl Reistout. Hey, Cheryl, how are you?
Good morning, Michael.
Are you able to keep warm these days?
I am staying indoors as much as possible.
You know, anytime it gets like really cold, like we just experienced, that's when, you know, I really want baseball to start. And I really can't wait for this season, primarily because, you know, I'm excited for the White Sox and the Cubs look like they're doing pretty well. Why don't we start on the White Sox? It seems like they're having a pretty good season out there so far.
Yeah, I mean, the bats are showing up. We're not seeing much with their starting pitching because they did not want to show some of their divisional rivals like the Kansas City Royals, any of their starters. So you're not going to see much of that. Lucas Giolito has had that strain muscle in his chest. He's supposed to be coming back sooner. He has been throwing a little bit, but to see him on the mound to actually pitch in the game is going to be really important for him. He's going to be the opening day starter, no doubt about that, as far as Ricky Renteria goes. But Edwin Encarnacion, he did not play recently because he's got a back injury, and Yasmani Grandal has got a calf strain. So those are a little bit concerning. However, when you look at this team collectively, you do have a James McCann, another all-star catcher, you know, so he can fill any missing time with Grandal. And also you got, you know, players like Luis Robert, who is really showing his speed. He's showing his power, and he's showing his complete athleticism in center field. So there's some really good stories working right now.
You know, Cheryl, we've been hearing a lot about the White Sox young stars, Luis Roberts, one of them. Is there any fear that, well, first of all, do we think Luis Robert might actually make this team the opening day in Chicago?
Oh, he's making the team. That's why they signed him to his contract, so they don't have to worry about service time with him. Otherwise, they would have put, you know, they would have waited till May to do it. No, he's going to be with the team, no doubt about it. The only player that's questionable as far as that concerned would be Nick Madrigal. He's somebody that they probably will send to AAA, and right now it's going to look like Louis Garcia is going to do his spot at second base. But I think eventually you're going to see Nick Madrigal. No, Luis Robert will be on the team, will be playing center field. And as far as where he's at in the lineup, it's going to be interesting because Ricky Renteria kind of, you know, really surprised everybody when he actually had him leading off the first game. But don't expect that. That's going to be Tim Anderson or Yoan Moncada's spot.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is there any fear that with so many, you know, up-and-coming stars for the White Sox that someone could be maybe not get as often to shine as much, like a Nick Madrigal, he may not join the team? And I mean, could there be any chance that he can get kind of low in terms of confidence?
No. You know what I know about Ricky Renteria, and I know about that his staff, is that they talk to their players daily. They know what's going on. They understand, you know, the situation. And Michael, the one thing about the White Sox have now that they hadn't had prior to the rebuild is having people compete for jobs. You know, making people accountable, making people like, you have to push harder. That wasn't the case just 4 years ago. Now every player knows that they have to reach a certain standard in order to be on this roster. And that's a good thing for the White Sox, and it's good for their future, and it's good for them, their present, because that means they want to win. And that's something that everyone's hoping they can do by the end of the season, is maybe, you know, have a really nice record, maybe get in the playoffs. But you got to start with that mindset that you want to win, and competing is really important.
You know, Cheryl, you mentioned how the White Sox didn't really want to show their starters too much to their division rivals like the Royals. We heard a lot about the Bears not playing their starters in the preseason. Is it really the same thing, or is it just the pitchers are going to get their playing time, just not in front of their division rivals?
Right. They are getting their they have games in behind the main stadium part. They have like, you know, little games that they do there. And then you're going to see in the next week, you're going to see the rotation coming into play. You're going to see Ronaldo Lopez on the mound again. You're going to see Lucas Giolito. You're going to see, you know, Michael Kopech. You're going to see these players. Dallas Keuchel, he did pitch the other day. So you're going to see some of these, you know, guys. They like to slowly build them up so that they're at the right peak moment once the season starts March 26th. And so you're going to see everything start gearing up for the pitchers in the next week, next 2 weeks. And by the time they get to, you know, coming back to Chicago, they should be without injuries, ready to go.
Okay, I could hear a lot of people now out there at home or listening into the car saying, hey, what is it, Michael Puente, talk about the Cubs? Okay, let's talk about the Cubs, Cheryl. How are the Cubs doing this year in spring training?
Well, I'll tell you, one player that's really improved his batting stance is Albert Almora Jr. He is really hitting the ball well, which is something that, you know, the Cubs management has been wanting to see. He's changed his stance. He's changed his approach. So you're seeing positive results with him. Unfortunately, they do have some unfortunate news with Brad Wick. They're one of the left-hand relievers, a young left-hand reliever that they had last year and was seeing some promise. He had a heart abnormal heartbeat and had to come back to Chicago for an implant. So he's back with the team. It's questionable how soon he'll be able to really, you know, get into gear as far as pitching again. John Lester got roughed up his first start this week. So, you know, you always wonder at what point a veteran with so many miles on him, how far he can go. And, you know, he's going to be, I don't think he'll be the opening day starter. I think it's going to be Yu Darvish, if anybody's going to be it. But David Ross, he's finally back. He had the flu. He missed the first few games. He had to go to the hospital for an IV. So he's back, and so he's now the commander in this team. And he allowed the crazy John Lackey to show up there and just, you know, hang out with the guys. And I can't imagine the conversations going on with John Lackey and John Lester and David Ross.
Yeah, it's just amazing. Let me ask you this, Cheryl. You know, some of the bigger news lines right now in Major League Baseball is the Houston Astro controversy. They won the World Series a couple of years ago. People say they cheated, stole signs. There's a lot of indication of that happening. They came out with a kind of a sorry, not sorry statement a couple of weeks ago, which they got bashed for. And we're hearing that a lot of Astros are starting to, you know, get hit in spring training. Is that correct?
They've had the most hits batsmen. They had seven times players have gotten hit. Now, the fact is, most of the time, players are working on their control, and there's some young pitchers in there. But we haven't seen any retaliation as far as any penalties yet. If it starts continuing, and if we start seeing, you know, their flamethrowers starting these guys, it's going to be interesting how that's taken. But, you know, Rob Manfred, he had an edict down telling the managers that they, you know, you can't hit these guys. There's a lot of anger about what happened, and rightfully so. These guys cheated. They cheated. They used the means that was only supposed to be used for instant replay for Major League Baseball. They used that to steal signs, and they got away with it, basically because, yes, some people lost their jobs. You know, the manager lost his job, the general manager lost his job. No player was suspended. And so there's a lot of anger about that, because if you're the L.A. Dodgers or the Yankees, you're very angry because that was a season that you lost to a cheater. So there's a lot of, it's on the minds of the players. And we're hearing it from, we've heard it from all sorts of players, including players like Chris Bryant and Mike Trout. These are guys that are not very vocal about this stuff, but they were very upset about it. So it's going to be interesting how this plays out. I think that the union should have gotten together, and actually collectively, and they should do it at some point, and say, look, no Astro players should be in the All-Star game, and the Astros should not play in postseason. That would probably go a long way to at least put a Band-Aid on the situation for a while.
Yeah, it seems like Major League Baseball is somehow going to have to address this because, you know, if it's bad now, wait till the Houston Astros starts touring all these, you know, going on the road. And, you know, it may not be pretty.
It won't be pretty. The only thing that's going to help them is the fact that all the stadiums now have netting around the infield. I mean, it sounds, you know, but people can't throw things at them. So they're going to hear boos. They're going to, and I know people are going to try to, you know, simulate, having trash cans being hit. And there's going to be a lot of things going on vocally, but at least the players will be protected. Because unfortunately, because of the situation, people have taken to the nth degree, and some Astro players have been getting death threats, which is just unfathomable that anybody would try to, you know, would even send a death threat because of a baseball game.
Right. Well, Cheryl, listen, I've been sitting at home, minding my own business, relaxing, looking forward to baseball season, not really thinking about basketball, IU basketball, Indiana University basketball. They're not doing pretty good. So the Bulls were pretty much left for dead. And then this week, what happened with Coby White? He's like this superstar now. What's going on with him?
You know what? It's confidence with him. He had the All-Star break, and, you know, he was snubbed for the Rising Stars game. And he was here in Chicago, and, you know, he watched all the events going on. And he won't admit to it really, you know, publicly, but there was a stinging feeling about that. And he just turned 20 years old 2 weeks ago. We think about how young he is, and
20.
He's a shooter. He's not a point guard, really. And that's, you know, what he's supposed to be, but he's a two guard, and that's why he's coming off the bench too. And people, you know, they don't like the fact that he's coming off the bench, but Zach LaVine has been carrying the load offensively, and when the second unit comes in, that's when it's melted. But with Coby White being able to sustain this 30-point-plus, you know, scoring tear, it's really helped the team. It's helped him. He's the first rookie to come off the bench and score consecutive games of 30 points in NBA history.
Wow.
Think about that. And only the second Bulls rookie since Michael Jordan to do it.
I mean, there's been a lot of talk about whether he should be in the starting lineup or not. I think he's earned it at this point.
I think, you know, a lot of people are clamoring for that, and I understand that. But realistically, sometimes a player his first years, like, you know, Tony Kukoc was the sixth man, and everyone was like, boy, he should have been a starter. But sometimes certain players at the beginning of the career, he's not comfortable, he's really playing well. The other aspect is they're bringing some of their injured players back. You're going to see Wendell Carter Jr. coming back against the Knicks, and you're going to see Denzel Valentine coming back, even though he's always been in the doghouse for whatever reason, I don't understand. But so the scoring could be different with the first unit, and Carter won't be on the court that much. So Kobe's going to have more opportunities to shoot the basket coming off the bench than he may have as a starter. So there, that has to come into play too. But it's really to talk to him, to watch him play, he's so quick. He gets to the rim. He could shoot from the outside, and he just is the confidence there, and his ability is really fun to watch develop at this point.
Well, Cheri, we just got a couple of more minutes. Tell us really quick, the NFL players are voting on a new collective bargaining offer that will expand the playoffs and add a game. How certain is that, that's actually going to happen?
They only need 51% of the 2,000-plus players to agree on it. It's a 10-year deal. It's probably going to happen. They're going to get 60% of the players are going to get a $100,000 raise. This will also, you know, being a 10-year contract, they didn't have to do the contract now. It would be, you know, next year is when it was supposed to be up. There's belief that that's what's going to happen, but a lot of players want it, especially the top-tier players, wanted the franchise tag to be eliminated, and that didn't happen. So it's going to be the bulk. I think it's going to be the bulk of the players are going to agree to are the ones that are on the, you know, not the stars. And so there's more non-stars in the NFL than stars. So that's why it'll probably be passed.
Well, you can catch all of Cheryl Ray Stout's reports on WBEZ in Chicago. Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us again on
No
Off
worries.
Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, that's all the time we have for today on Off Mic. I'd like to thank my producer for today's show, the fabulous Dee Dotson. Always great to have her here. And you can hear me the rest of the week on WBEZ in Chicago. So everyone here on Off Mic and on Lakeshore Public Radio, have a great weekend, stay warm, and go enjoy some fish.